Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Killett, your host. Happy Halloween to you. Thanks so much for being here with us on Halloween. And I will say this because I know we have young listeners who might need to be reminded. There's little tiny little people out today and they're going to trip over their costumes. So drive extra slow and extra carefully, please. Those of you who are on the road, the number here is 888-318-7884 and a perfect opportunity to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Therefore, I don't know why I just gave out the phone number. I just looked and noticed I have all the questions. Jimmy Akin is our guest senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the podcaster behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin Podcast. Hi, Jimmy. Happy Halloween.
Howdy, how's it going? Happy Halloween to you too.
It's going very well. It's going very well. I for a moment there, I forgot we have the questions. It's a weird question show, and I've got a ton of weird questions for you. I had a thought, though, that it's Halloween. It's a Friday. There must be something spooky on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Was I right or not?
Well, there's usually something spooky on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Well, that's true, yeah.
But today it's also a fifth Friday, so today it's weird questions, so that's spooky. And the lead weird question for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is, did Jesus have extraterrestrial sheep?
I have forgotten that question. I did that question with you? Mm-hmm. I have forgotten. Did Jesus have extraterrestrials? Now I got to go back and listen. I that does not seem like one that I would forget. Check it out at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts, or go to the Jimmy Akin YouTube channel. There's a ton of stuff on the Jimmy Akin YouTube channel. Jimmy, off we go. And I'm very grateful we're starting with a ghost question. This is the perfect day to start with a ghost question. Philip325 wanted to know this. If ghosts may be souls from purgatory, whom God has permitted for a particular reason to appear and interact with the living, why don't all ghosts ask for masses to be said for them?
Okay, so there's several parts to this question. Now, Philip says, if ghosts may be souls from purgatory, and that's an if. And he's left open another possibility, which is that some ghosts might not be souls from purgatory. There also could be ghosts from heaven or hell. Now, we commonly interpret the appearances of souls from heaven as something other than ghosts, but fundamentally it goes in the same category of an appearance of a departed human spirit. In parapsychology, there's a standard term that's applied to all of them, and it's actually the same term that historically has been used for the appearance of any spirit. You can hear how the word appearance sounds like apparition. That's where it comes from. And so an appearance of any spirit would be an apparition. Now, if the spirit comes from heaven, then the spirit doesn't need masses said for it. And so it wouldn't ask for them. If a soul is from hell, and Aquinas thought that souls from hell can occasionally manifest to human beings, then masses won't help it, and it presumably wouldn't ask for them either. It's only if they're in that middle category of souls from purgatory that they would ask for masses to be said. But why don't they all do that? Well, Martin Luther, the famous Protestant reformer, had a very interesting opinion on that. People may not know this, but he apparently coined the term poltergeist. In German, poltern means noisy or rattling, And Geist means ghost or spirit. And so a poltergeist is a noisy ghost or a noisy spirit. And this word appears for the first time in German in Martin Luther's writings. Now, historically, now for people who may not be familiar, a poltergeist is what happens when you have unusual object motion, like, you know, books are flying around, people hear bangs and thumps, there may be weird things happening with water or fire or things like that. And historically, it was commonly assumed that a spirit was involved, since, you know, they couldn't see any human, living human agent producing this activity. It was assumed it must be a spirit. In the mid-20th century, though, another theory developed in parapsychology that explains poltergeists, or many poltergeists, as not actually being due to a departed spirit, but to a living human who is basically under stress, and they don't feel they can vent their frustrations openly, so their subconscious kind of throws a psychokinetic temper tantrum. And there are ways, if that's the case, which appears to be what's going on in many poltergeist instances, though not all of them, there are ways of helping that person out, like getting stress management help can cause the poltergeist activity to subside, which is evidence that in this case, the poltergeist activity was produced by a living person. But that was, you know, 400 years after Martin Luther. Back then, he assumed that it's a spirit that's involved. And his question was, well, what kind of spirit is it? And he had a very interesting argument. He said that all poltergeists must be deceptive spirits. And the reason was, the first thing they do is ask Mass to be said for them. And Martin Luther was not a fan of the Catholic Mass. So he took the fact that so many poltergeists asked for Mass to be said as evidence that they must be deceptive spirits, not on God's team. So that was Martin Luther's argument. I would say, while it's an interesting argument, it's a load of fetid dingo's kidneys. Now, having said that, let's approach Philip's question directly in a Catholic context. Why don't all ghosts ask for Masses to be said for them? And there are a number of possibilities. I mentioned two. The ghost might already be in heaven, or it might be someone manifesting from hell. But assuming they're in purgatory, why don't they ask for Mass to be said for them in every case? Well, Psychelet.
Yes.
You're not in heaven yet, or hell. So Mass could be a benefit to you. Do you ask every person you meet to have Mass said for you?
It had not even occurred to me, Jimmy. It had not even occurred to me.
Okay, so why doesn't it occur to you to ask everyone you meet to have Mass said for you?
I don't know. It just never did. I don't know. No one ever suggested that as a course of action. I never thought of it.
Let me make a suggestion.
Okay.
You have other more pressing matters to talk to other people about besides, could you have Mass said for me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And if that's true of you, because you're not in heaven or hell yet, the same thing could be true of a soul that's in purgatory. They may have more pressing things they need to deal with at the moment. For example, their relatives who are still alive may be really broken up about their loss. And the soul in purgatory may judge that it is more important in this moment to assure my loved ones on earth that I'm okay, that they don't need to worry about me being eternally lost. And so they may take the opportunity to assure them of that. On the other hand, they may have unfinished business on earth. Like maybe they wronged somebody and they need to put that right. In fact, putting that right may even be part of their purgation in purgatory. So rather than asking for Mass to be said, they may say, hey, I did you wrong. I apologize. And that may be part of their purgation. So even though mass is very valuable, and we should definitely have mass said for people who have died, in a given moment, it may not be the most pressing urgency. And so we shouldn't assume a simplistic model of what's going to help a particular ghost the most in a particular moment. They may have other things they need to clear away, in, for example, in order to have the mass have its full benefit for them. And frankly, even though obviously the sacrifice of Christ is infinite in value and thus in principle is enough to deal with any person's problems, and you might think that therefore having mass said for someone is going to be the most pressing thing in all cases, well, that would be true in this life as well. And yet God indicates, and human experience indicates, that in this life, it's often not the most pressing thing we need to do for someone in this life. And the same could therefore be true of someone who's in purgatory in the next life. But as Father Martin Luther assured us, lots of ghosts do ask for masses to be said for them.
So many that we could that we have to have some response for why they are. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Happy Halloween to you. It is All Hallows Eve, and we've got a lot more weird questions for Jimmy coming right up.
Catch Catholic Answers live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after. What happens beyond that Damascus moment?
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. It's a Friday. It's Halloween. Now, I what I usually say on Halloween is, because it's the Feast of All Hallows that follows, it's All Saints Day tomorrow, but I think that has been moved to Sunday, the celebration of it, but I could be wrong about that. I probably should have looked it up before. I just thought of it just now because I was about to say, hey, tomorrow is All Saints Day. I'll tell you what, I'll look it up at the break, and I'll let you know when we're celebrating All Saints Day this year. I'm not exactly sure when that is, because it's on a Saturday, of course, so it may have been moved to the Sunday. Jimmy Akin, the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, here to take questions. And all the questions are in, and we gather them up. If they're weird enough, we ask Jimmy. And this one comes from Jim.
Actually, let's answer the question you just raised.
Oh, okay.
Which was what's going on with the Feast of All Saints. And according to the U.S. Bishops' Complementary Norms, which are easy to find if you type in U.S. Complementary Norms, whenever January 1st, the Solemnity of Mary, Mother of God, or August 15th, the Solemnity of the Assumption, or November 1st, the Solemnity of All Saints falls on a Saturday or on a Monday, the precept to attend Mass is abrogated. So it's not transferred. It's just not a holy day of obligation.
Ah, okay. All right. So it's just not a holy day of obligation. Very helpful. Thank you, Jimmy. I appreciate that. I realized I started talking and didn't know the answer once I started talking. But this one comes from Jim. Why, Jimmy, in your opinion, would God allow hauntings which act as non-interactive recording or psychic imprint, which mm-hmm. seems to repeat over and over again in the same place and may even be left by people who are still alive, mm-hmm. as opposed to singularly unique and interactive apparitions of the dead.
Okay. So I want to compliment Jim for knowing the meaning of the term haunting in its more academic sense. In colloquial English speech, a haunting is the same thing as an apparition. It's when a ghost is appearing. But in parapsychology, there's been a good bit of research done about certain types of phenomena known as hauntings, where it appears that the same thing just happens over and over again. Like you see a person descend in a staircase every day at 3 p.m. and that's all that ever happens. If you wave at the person or say hi to the person or yell to the person, they just walk down the staircase. They don't acknowledge you at all. So this acts as if it's some kind of recording. It's not interactive. You can't hold a conversation with it. And consequently, parapsychologists have proposed, well, that's what it is then. If it acts like a recording, then it is a recording. So we don't have evidence here of an interactive spirit. We have evidence that some kind of imprint was left, or place memory was left in this location, and we're just picking up on that memory. And this is the common parapsychological understanding of what a haunting is. Sometimes they are called residual hauntings to indicate that they're caused by some kind of like psychic residue that has been left in a location rather than being due to the presence of a spirit. And Jim is correct that they are left by living people. They are, you know, because, you know, it's living people that leave recordings. If you watch the movie Top Hat from the 1930s with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, you know, that's a recording. But Fred and Ginger recorded it when they were still alive. And you could watch that movie for many years while they were still alive. So the person that created the haunting may or may not still be alive at the time you're experiencing the haunting. And, you know, this is just one form of ways that people can leave imprints in their environment. For example, Cy Kellett, yes. You live in San Diego.
Right.
And that's on the left-hand side of America. And in more ways than one. And one of the things about San Diego is its beach community. And so you have beaches there. Do you ever go down to the beach, Cy Kellett?
Yes, quite frequently.
Okay.
Sure.
So when you go down to the beach, do you walk along the beach?
Yes.
And when you walk along the beach, do you leave footprints?
I do. Yes.
Good.
I have
noticed
that.
You're not a ghost. You're not a ghost then.
And I can see myself in a mirror too. So I feel pretty solid.
That's vampires. That's different.
Okay.
Okay. So you leave footprints on the beach, and thus you leave traces in your environment that indicate your presence. Those footprints are a record of the steps that you took on the beach. And if someone comes along and sees those footprints, are you actually, is there a possibility you're still alive?
I thus far, every time I've been still alive. Yes. So far.
So this is like the haunting experience. And I'm glad that I would think that you would still be alive, since the tide comes in every day and therefore it'll wipe out those footprints before too long. So, in any event, you leave a record in your environment without intending to or trying to, just like someone in a residual haunting would. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, Cy Kellett, why would God allow you to leave footprints on the beach as opposed to people just having interactions with you after you're dead?
That's just the way the world works. I don't even know how to answer that question.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how things are. Like, you can leave marks on stuff.
That's my answer too. In regard to Jim Jameson's question, this is just how God set it up. We can leave records in our environment while we're alive, and they can continue to exist while we're alive. And therefore, there's not a binary choice between this and merely having interactions with us after our deaths. So we make records all the time, you know, footprints in sand, footprints in snow. You lay down, you make a snow angel. That's a record. You press record on a voice recorder, it makes a record of your voice. Someone points a video camera at you, it makes a record of you on video. Right now, you and I are doing a live stream, and that's a record of us having this conversation. So God just set up the world so that people can leave records in the world while they're still alive. And that applies apparently to what parapsychologists call hauntings too. They're just one more kind of record we can leave in the world.
Jim, thank you very much. I think I had heard you talk about that kind of record before, but I had forgotten about that, that there are hauntings that aren't actually a spirit hanging around. There's some other kind of thing. Again, Jim, thank you very much. This one comes from Jordan, who wants to know, what are the moral implications of using new technologies in the workplace, knowing that it could lead to other positions becoming obsolete and other employees being laid off? Example, someone needs to use AI or other forms of automation to meet the requirements of their job, but too much success could convince a CEO to completely replace another human position with technology.
Okay, so Jordan has asked a general question, which is about the moral implications of using technology in the workplace, knowing that it could lead to other positions becoming obsolete. He gives the current situation with AI being introduced as an example of that, but he's perceptively noticed that there's a more general question here that doesn't just apply to AI, it applies to any kind of new technology. So let's think about this a little bit. Now, currently, we have lots of people who use computers as part of their daily jobs. Did any of those jobs exist 50 years ago?
No. No.
No. So there were non-computer users who were employed prior to the introduction of computers into the modern workplace. And you go back a couple hundred years, and over in that period of time, we had the industrial age, where you started having manufacturing beginning to use identical parts. So not every part had to be custom made, and then goods were fashioned by putting together different identical parts. So like if you wanted to buy a gun, the gun would have parts that were molded, you know, where you pour metal into molds and then you assemble the gun out of those parts. But Sykel, wouldn't that have put out of business all the people who handmade guns and the parts for guns prior to the Industrial Revolution?
Some of them, the ones that didn't learn the new way of doing things, probably. But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's go back further. Now, of course, gun parts were commonly made out of, a lot of them were made out of iron, and specifically steel, but let's just say iron. And the Iron Age began in different locations prior to, you know, it varied, but let's say, in a few centuries BC was where the Iron Age started in a lot of places. So didn't the introduction of iron forging technology put out of business lots of people who had previously been part of the bronze economy during the Bronze Age?
It certainly did. I remember those days, Jimmy. It was awful.
And your memory may go back a little further because bronze technology, you know, people had swords and knives and stuff made out of bronze, but those replaced knives and stuff that were made out of stone. with the Stone Age.
Right.
So didn't all the new fancy bronze technology workers put people out of business in the Stone Age?
Fred, Barney, everybody out of business.
Yeah. A lot of those bronze workers, also some of them killed some of the previous Stone Age workers because they had better weapons. So we see that there has been, over the last several thousand years, a continual improvement of technologies, and each wave of technology, as it supersedes the previous economy, puts some folks out of business. And if we didn't allow that to happen, we would be stuck in the Stone Age. Now, Cy Kellett, question for you.
Yes.
Has it benefited mankind to not be stuck in the Stone Age?
I would say, in general, I've noticed some positive effects. Yes. Generally, okay. It's good not to be in the Stone Age.
So you would say it's fundamentally moral to allow technology to progress.
That's a great point.
Well, there's a little more to say, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's All Hallows Eve, also called Halloween. We'll come back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. A lot of little people going to be out in the streets, so careful driving tonight. We're happy to have you here. Thanks for joining us for this afternoon or evening's broadcast, depending on where you are. Maybe even it's your morning broadcast if you're over in Australia or Singapore or the Philippines. Wherever you are, we're always happy when you join us. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Weird Questions. And Jordan had a question that Jimmy wants to get back to. He was in the midst of answering it. And Jordan was saying, is it immoral to use technologies at work that might eliminate somebody else's job at work?
Yeah. So before the break, we established that if we didn't allow newer technologies to displace older ones, that we'd still be back in the Stone Age. And Cy Kellett, you were of the opinion that it's a good thing we're not back in the Stone Age. And so it's fundamentally moral to allow new technologies to supplant older ones.
Yes.
But, you know, there can be some exceptions to that. Like if someone wants to introduce a particular technology that would be fundamentally harmful to mankind, well, then you don't want to introduce that technology. So we're not saying all technology is universally good, but as a general matter, allowing technology to progress is, even though it's going to mean some people are going to lose jobs or have to retrain or something like that, is fundamentally moral. The question is going to be how you implement the new technology, assuming that it's fundamentally a good technology that is moral to introduce to begin with. The question is, how do you introduce it? And here, I think Catholic moral theology would hold that the technology, to the extent possible, should be introduced in such a way that it minimizes problems for people. Like, if you know you're going to lose lots of jobs because of a new technology, making sure there are other options for people, either other jobs they can get or their training programs so they can get up to speed with the new technology, or one way or another, if you can find ways to minimize the damage that's done through this process, which is known as creative destruction. Some jobs are destroyed, but it's due to added human creativity that ends up benefiting everybody. And so as part of this creative destruction, you want to minimize the destructive aspect of it, but that doesn't mean that you don't allow the technology to progress. It's just a question of how does it get introduced? How do you manage that transition? And how you manage it is going to depend on what the technology is, how rapidly it could be brought in, what alternatives exist in a particular society at the time. Can you afford programs to help people retrain and so forth? But fundamentally, as long as the technology itself is legitimate, then it can be introduced, even though it's going to mean some people are going to lose their jobs, but you need to try to manage that transition to minimize the harms that are being caused.
Jordan, thank you. A wonderful question for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And on we go to Daniel's question. Does the phenomenon of dead bodies being incorruptible only happen to saints, or does it happen to non-Catholics as well?
Well, it can happen to non-Catholics, but it could happen to a non-Catholic saint. However, incorruptibility also happens to people who we don't have any evidence are saints, whether they're Catholic or not. So this is a phenomenon that is not associated exclusively with those who we have evidence are saints. And consequently, even though you often hear reports about someone's body who is being considered for sainthood was excavated or disinterred, and it was found to be incorrupt to one degree or another, you often hear about that, but it's not actually one of the criteria that the church uses in judging sainthood, not these days. There may have been a time when it was given more weight and was looked at as a possible miracle that could confirm someone's sainthood. But as knowledge has progressed, we've learned that actually this happens in quite a number of different circumstances. And so it has become decoupled from sainthood. And today the church does not use incorruptibility as evidence that someone is in fact in heaven. It may be something that God allows to happen as kind of a sign to the faithful, but he also allows it to occur in other circumstances as well.
All right, Daniel, thank you. Miguel wants to know this. Can you explore Catholic themes and spirituality in the Star Wars universe? The Chosen One, the Force, Jedi Order, symbolism, sacrifice of Vader, redemption, etc. I know George Lucas is hardly Catholic, but perhaps he unwittingly drew on things found in the largest entity in the universe, the Catholic Church. Thanks, and may the Force be with you.
Okay, well, Miguel, I'm not so much a Star Wars guy myself. I have seen all 9 of the films and some additional Star Wars material. I'm not an expert in them, but one of the things I do know is this was not an accident. George Lucas consciously modeled elements in the Star Wars universe off of religious ideas. One of the things he did, and he talked about this, was he used a cycle that is known as the hero's journey, which was described by Joseph Campbell, a 20th century scholar of folklore and religion, who was into looking at how do different stories manifest and in different cultures. And one of the things he proposed, this is, I think it's an oversimplification, but he proposed that there's something he referred to as the monomyth, which he called the hero's journey. The idea of a monomyth is that it's the primal root myth that's at the basis of all other mythologies. And so you have this story where you have a hero. He doesn't start out necessarily functioning as a hero. He's a member of a community. And then something happens to cause him to leave that community. And he is invited into a larger world where he then goes on a journey that involves growth and development, and he ends up winning some kind of benefit or set of benefits. It could be skills, it could be magical items, it could be any number of things, but he ends up returning to his community as a hero and is able to bestow benefits as a result of the journey he's been on. And if you think about this story, it has, according to Campbell, not every element of this story appears every time it's told, but you can see this story in a lot of other, this pattern in a lot of other stories. Like, for example, Jesus Christ. He's born as a little baby. He grows, he matures, he's called to his ministry. He ends up conquering death on the cross and is able to return and bestow benefits on his followers. So Joseph Campbell, at least, would say that the hero's journey is reflected in the life story of Jesus Christ. It's also reflected in lots of other life stories, including Luke Skywalker. He's initially a farm boy on Tatooine. He's invited into a larger world by Obi-Wan Kenobi. He goes on this journey of growth, and he ends up destroying the Death Star and returning as a triumphant hero who has bestowed benefits on his community by destroying the Death Star. So this is basic drama. And even though I think Campbell, if you propose this as a true monomyth, I think that that's probably an oversimplification, but there is this basic story that you see in lots of drama. And George Lucas consciously adopted the hero's journey for the first Star Wars and more broadly across the Star Wars franchise. He also modeled specific things off religious elements. Not only is Luke Skywalker a Jesus Christ figure, but Anakin Skywalker also has parallels to Jesus Christ. He's not identical. I mean, he goes to the dark side. He gives in to the temptations that he's offered. But notice he's even born of a virgin. And because his mother did not have relations with a man, and yet she, due to a virgin's in the Force, she became pregnant and gave birth to Anakin Skywalker. We also have prominent themes of redemption here. We also have the Jedi Knights are basically a monastic order. They're like kind of like the Knights Templar. They have both a military side and they have a spiritual side. And they're also celibate. At least that's the way it's presented in the prequels. And Anakin, part of his giving into temptation involves his attraction to Padme Skywalker, where that's part of his literal and physical seduction to the dark side. That's the initial stage of it, which is then leveraged by Emperor Palpatine to get him to fully commit to the dark side. So we have lots of this stuff. And, of course, we have the Force itself. Miguel closed his question by saying, thanks and may the Force be with you. Cy Kellett, do you happen to know where the may the Force be with you comes from?
It sounds so much like peace be with you from the Catholic Mass.
Pretty close. What it actually comes from is, may the Lord be with you.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, that's even closer. Yeah.
And that's where George Lucas took it from. He took it from the Christian liturgy. He took may the Lord be with you and changed the Lord to the Force. And the Force, even though it's articulated in different science fiction-y ways and different Star Wars properties, fundamentally, it's a symbol of God, of the unknown. Now, it also can incorporate a dark side that's a symbol of evil, but when the Force is used correctly, it's a symbol of God. And all of this was conscious. Lucas has talked about this in interviews going back decades. And so he very definitely was using religious symbolism in his construction of the Star Wars universe. Unfortunately, that didn't stop the sequel trilogy from being made. Because that's just blasphemy.
Miguel, thanks very much for the question. I think I better take a break, then we'll come back with some more weird questions on this Halloween afternoon for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchick, and Raymond Arroyo. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Tons and tons of weird questions for this Halloween afternoon. Glad you're here with us. This next one comes from My Home TD6SV.
Mm-hmm.
And My Home TD6SV wants to know, are mine and my husband's guardian angels friends? Is my guardian angel friends with my children's angels? Or is my angel like a mentor to my children's angels?
Okay, so let's deal with the first two questions, because they're going to have a common answer. And the answer is going to depend on what you mean by friend. The concept of friendship can be understood in more than one way. It could mean someone you have positive relations with. And so anyone you have positive relations with, you could be considered your friend. On the other hand, it could mean having special positive relations with them. You may have positive relations with lots of people, but those you consider your friends are those you have especially positive relations with. So you can use the word friend in different senses. In the broad sense of just someone you have positive relations with, I would say it's fair to say that all of the angels connected with your family, whether they're yours, your husband's, or your children's, all of them have positive relations with each other. there. And so they're all friends in that sense. The question would be, do they have special positive relations with each other compared to other angels, so that they're friends in the more special sense of friendship? And on that one, I can't answer as confidently, but it seems to me that since they're working to protect the same group of people that is bound by positive relations to each other within your family, or at least what should be positive relations, I would suspect, since these angels are working on the same team to protect the same human team, namely your family, it would be reasonable to propose that at least right now, while they're guarding y'all, they do have special positive relations with each other compared to, say, a family, a group of angels that's protecting a family on the far side of the planet that you don't know. So I think it's a reasonable conjecture. I think it's certain they all are friends in the sense of they have positive relations with each other. And I think it's a reasonable conjecture to propose that because they're bound together working towards the same goal in protecting your family members, that they're also currently friends in a more special sense than that. But that's more speculative. When it comes to the third question, is your angel like a mentor to your children's angels? I would say, I would give a different answer. I would say, I don't know, but probably not. Because while there is a natural law hierarchy among humans that includes your family, so that you and your husband are the leaders in your family and the children are the followers because they're younger and they're still growing and still maturing and don't know as much as you and your husband, none of that applies to the angels. In the first place, the angel's job is to get these individual people they're assigned to heaven and to protect them. And that doesn't require any kind of natural law hierarchy among the angels that are protecting your family. Also, angels do not grow and develop the way humans do. So it's not like you've got child angels assigned to, you know, angels don't reproduce. So it's not like you've got child angels assigned to your children and adult angels assigned to you and your husband. So there's not a natural hierarchy in the angelic community that mirrors the hierarchy of the human family, so far as we know. If there were such a hierarchy, it would have to be different in some ways than the human family because, as I said, angels don't reproduce. So I think it's fair to say your angels are all friends, maybe in a special sense, but I probably wouldn't ascribe mentorship to your angel or your husband's angel compared to your children's angels.
My home, TD6SV. Thank you very much for the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's weird questions for Jimmy, and we'll continue with another guardian angel question. Teresa wants to know this, Jimmy. If one's guardian angel were asked to console Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, would the angel be allowed to do it?
Okay. I assume that Teresa is asking, like, if today you asked your guardian angel to console Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, you can certainly make that request, you know, whether you make it directly to the angel or whether you make it to God and say, could you have my guardian angel console Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane? And the fact that Christ was in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, 2,000 years ago, that's not a barrier. Because God is outside of time, and so he can respond to your question, to your request, at any moment in the course of history. Also, and this I find this can help some people grasp this a little better, even if God were not outside of time, and he is, but even if he were not, he's still omniscient. He knows everything. So back in AD 33, when Christ was in the Garden of Gethsemane, God knew in AD 33, even though he's not really in time, but he would have known in AD 33 that in 2025, you were going to ask your guardian angel to do this. So he would foresee your request and thus could act on it in AD 33, even if he was not outside of time, which he is. So how likely is it that that this would request would be granted? There, I don't think we know. We don't know what consolations God permitted Jesus to have in the Garden of Gethsemane. We also don't know what angels were permitted to do with respect to him. We know there was at least one angel there because we're told that, but we don't know if there were, you know, all of the angels trying to comfort him, or, you know, if God may have imposed limits we don't know about. Now, I don't think one of those limits would be a physical limit. You know, if you imagine, let's say, okay, there's 100 billion people in the history who have been born in the history of the world. Well, if all of their guardian angels chose to try to console Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that's something the angels would want to do, whether you ask them to or not, they would want Jesus to be consoled. Well, then that would be 100 billion angels and trying to console Jesus. And if you try to imagine that, and if you imagine angels having physical bodies, you know, how do you get 100 billion in one little garden? You know, that doesn't make sense. But the fact is, angels do not have physical bodies. And so I don't think there would be a physical limitation on the angels being, on that number of angels being able to console Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. I think it more likely that God would impose other limitations on what the angels could do. For example, Cycelid.
Yes.
If you've got 100 billion angels consoling you,
yes,
I would say that involves quite a lot of consolation, right?
Yes, that's a lot of consolation, yes.
Yeah, okay, so there's 100 billion angels wanting to console Jesus, but God doesn't want Jesus to console. He wants him to go to the cross and not just be blissed out and happy and everything like that. He's allowing his son to suffer in order to redeem us. And so my suspicion is God would have imposed a limit on the angelic consolation that Jesus might receive based on the fact that Jesus needs to suffer in this situation. And so I would say that fundamentally the answer to the question, can you ask your guardian angel to console Jesus in the garden? You can ask, but I would say you got to leave it up to God after that. There may be limits, some of which humans may not even be capable of understanding, that would prevent that from happening. Although I think we can feel confident that God and the angels would want Jesus to be consoled within the boundaries that needed to happen in that situation.
Teresa, thank you very much. A couple of guardian angel questions. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You want to take the next?
They were new guardian angel questions. They weren't.
I know.
Yeah.
Usually, the most common guardian angel question is what happens to my guardian angel when I die? I think.
They didn't ask that.
Yeah, they have to report to their superior on all that you did and didn't do. What's on the Jimmy Akin podcast this week, Jimmy? Every Monday we get the Jimmy Akin podcast. So what did we get this Monday?
So this Monday I had an episode on the synoptic problem. The synoptic gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and there's a clear relationship between them. And the question is, what is that relationship? So I went through some of the most commonly proposed explanations for how they might be related. I mentioned the one that I tend to favor, and in a future episode, I'll explain why I favor it. But this episode was all about explaining the synoptic problem in general and what some of the major options are. On this coming Monday, I'm going to be talking about the Bible Codex, which is a mystery that we haven't fully solved.
Oh, man. That was a terrible cliffhanger. I had follow-ups. All right, we'll just have to leave it there. You can check out the Jimmy Akin podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can also check out Jimmy's, not page, channel on YouTube. We talked a little earlier about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the Jimmy Akin podcast, and lots of other stuff.
You're mastering that internet lingo, channel rather than page.
I'm not mastering it. I'm trying to master it. But man, I need some mentorship. I need a little guardian angel mentorship. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.